He smiled sweetly beneath his thick spectacles at the glaring eyes in the rearview mirror. Was Kevin's vein in his neck turning green? Hey, good and wonderful people. How the heck are you? This is Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Really pleased that you join me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and James A. Hearn bring us the first story today, and it's called Shane on the Scene. December 20th, 1969, Fort Worth, Texas. The suburban streets of southwest Fort Worth were a washed-out gray in the pre-dawn light of Saturday morning. In the back seat of a 1969 Cadillac Fleetwood, Shane Mitchell rested his head against the cool glass of his window. With every pothole, the boy's head bumped the glass. Pothole, bump. Pothole, bump, bump. S.O.S. Save our Shane. He wondered if the window might break, and he realized he wouldn't care if it did. Oh, he'd catch hell, but it might be worth it to see the throbbing vein in Kevin Cook's oversized neck. The man who'd soon be his stepfather was headed for a heart attack, but hopefully not while Shane and his mother were passengers in Kevin's beloved new car. In the front seat, Evelyn Mitchell rested her blonde head on Kevin's burly shoulder. It turned Shane's stomach to watch them together. The boy asked himself, not for the first time, why she'd bring such a jerk into their lives. It was a mystery that would baffle even the combined forces of the Hardy Boys and Scooby-Doo. Speaking of mysteries, Kevin was on a whirlwind spending spree the past few months, including paying cash for this decked-out Cadillac. While any other 12-year-old kid might relish being picked up from school in a new car, Shane had read enough detective stories to know that a sudden flash of cash could be a sign of something sinister. He just didn't know what. There's nothing diabolical going on with Kevin, Evelyn Mitchell told her son one morning over breakfast. If he has extra money, it's because his ship has come in after years of hard work. Then she dropped the mother of all bombshells. Kevin had proposed, and they were getting married in Las Vegas on Christmas Day. The news struck Shane like a thunderbolt. For a full minute, he sat quietly listening to the snap, crackle, and pop of his Rice Krispies. In the growing silence, his mother drummed her lacquered nails on the breakfast table. Shane, aren't you going to say something? Like what, Mom? Like, I'm happy for you, or congratulations, Mom? Shane's spoon slipped from his fingers and disappeared into his cereal bowl with a sudden splash of milk. He tried not to take it as a metaphor for his life. Well, sure, I'll say something. Kevin Cook is a creep. He's running some con with his business, and he's conned you, too. Evelyn Mitchell gasped. You think he's a con man and a creep? Yes, Shane said. He was well aware he sounded like a petulant child, and he struggled to keep his adolescent voice from breaking. He didn't succeed. And Kevin hates me. Oh, Shane, Kevin does not hate you. Yes, he does, Shane didn't say. He's no good for you, Mom. You deserve better. But Shane's mother wouldn't hear another word against Kevin. For reasons Shane couldn't begin to understand, she didn't share his concerns about Kevin's character. As for the man's finances, she explained, he owned a shipping company that had recently won some federal contracts. He was living the American dream, and she encouraged Shane to accept her fiancé's good fortune as their own. As for her temper, Kevin just needs the right woman to settle him down, Evelyn finished. He needs me. why his mother couldn't find a man who was already settled, Shane didn't know. He fished out his spoon, finished his soggy cereal, and rode the bus to school in a daze. That was 4 months ago. "Viva Las Vegas," Kevin sang from the front seat. The man loved Elvis, but his impersonation sounded more like Tiny Tim with a head cold. Shane groaned. The two lovebirds were flying to Las Vegas for a Christmas wedding and leaving Shane with an uncle he'd met only once at a family reunion. Uncle Rob, or was it Uncle Bob, had recently moved to Texas from California. Or was it New York? Shane couldn't remember, and it didn't matter anyway. Nothing really mattered anymore. Was it wrong of Shane to hope the plane to Vegas would crash, killing only Kevin? He imagined a smoking wreckage surrounded by emergency crews as a smiling reporter delivered the grim news. "Well, early this morning, Flight 95 from Dallas to Las Vegas crashed shortly after takeoff. Miraculously, there was only one fatality. Local businessman Kevin Cook, CEO of Cook Carriers, he will not be missed by anyone." "Shane!" Kevin bellowed. His voice was a wounded elephant crashing through the savannah. "For the last time, quit bumping your giant egghead against the glass." Shane didn't move. The Cadillac hit another pothole, giving his head a good bump, and he smiled sweetly beneath his thick spectacles at the glaring eyes in the rearview mirror. Was the vein in Kevin's neck turning green? "I swear to God, I'll stop this car," Kevin said. Oh, yes, it was green and throbbing. "Don't pull over, honey," Evelyn purred. "We're running late already, and I don't want to miss our flight." Shane recognized this calming voice as the one his mother used to soothe Kevin's temper whenever it flared and searched for something to burn. Sometimes the flames were smothered by Evelyn's charms and good graces, but sometimes they were not. "You make him stop or I will," Kevin growled.
"You're not my stepfather yet," Shane said, "and you're not half the man my dad was."
Whether that was true or not, Shane didn't know. Mike Mitchell had died of cancer when his only son was still in diapers. The car swerved toward the curb to stop, but Evelyn tugged the wheel back to center and said,
"Drive, Kevin."
She turned to Shane, her blue eyes glinting.
"Sit up straight in your seat, son. Now."
"Yes, ma'am." Shane straightened up while doing his best to look miserable. It took no effort.
"That's better. Want to look at your Viewmaster?"
"Okay." Shane unzipped his duffel bag and retrieved the red plastic viewer and a package of white discs with small pictures on them. He inserted a disc into a slot on the viewer, took off his spectacles, and brought the toy to the bridge of his nose. He aimed it at the passing streetlights and gave his imagination free rein. Overlaid pictures within the viewer created the illusion of three dimensions, transporting Shane into the world of his favorite TV show, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? With a creative mind fueled by television and books, Shane became an amateur detective fighting crime. Sometimes he was Frank Hardy, sleuthing around Bayport with his younger brother Joe. Today, Shane was riding around in the Mystery Machine with lifelong friends and a talking Great Dane.
"Let all the monsters beware! Shane is on the scene!"
"Is that thing for dirty pictures?" Kevin asked.
Shane suppressed a sigh. Some monsters were as close as the front seat of a car.
"It's a Viewmaster," Evelyn answered for Shane. "You got it for his birthday, remember?"
"What? So what's it do?"
"It takes two pictures on a disc and creates one three-dimensional image," Shane answered.
Kevin barked a laugh.
"Ha! Bull! Everyone knows you can't see in three dimensions without 3D glasses."
"That's Rob's house," Evelyn said.
She pointed to a red brick home with bars over the windows and security cameras mounted at the corners. To Shane, it looked like a jail.
"Well, this is your stop," Kevin said as he pulled over. His unctuous voice was thinly concealing glee, like a sheen of oil shining in a million prisms over brackish water. He kept the engine running and made no move to help Shane with his bag.
"I guess chivalry is dead, huh?" Evelyn said. Kevin didn't take the hint.
"Ain't you liberated or something?"
Sighing, Evelyn exited the car and opened Shane's door. Her son folded his arms across his chest and stared straight ahead. Evelyn glanced nervously at Kevin.
"Don't make this difficult, Shane.
I don't want to stay with Uncle Bob."
"He's your Uncle Rob, and he's part of our family. Get your bag, young man, please."
Shane obeyed, and not because please was the magic word. It was because his mother was genuinely scared that Volcano Kevin might erupt. Still, Shane couldn't mask the disappointment on his face. She was doing it. She was actually leaving him with a strange relative so she could marry some jerk with money. Kevin Cook, a.k.a. Kevin Crook, would come back from Las Vegas as his stepfather. Ugh.
Bag in hand, Shane stood morosely before his mother. The December wind was brisk, blowing dead leaves down the street in swirls of yellowish brown. It was the sidewalk at the end of the world.
"Now then," his mother said, "I expect you to be a good boy while you're with Uncle Rob."
"Yes, ma'am."
She put on her best smile, and the wintry world became a bit brighter because of it.
"I'm getting married on Christmas, but that won't change how things are between us. Not ever. We're all going to be happy. I promise."
"Hey, Shane," Kevin called from the car. "If this uncle asks if you want to pitch a tent on his bed, you say no, understand?"
"Kevin,"
Evelyn cried,
"you're talking about my brother."
"It's the quiet ones you gotta watch," Kevin said. "I'll bet old Robbie has a room full of pictures of cheating husbands with their mistresses, probably to look at the husbands."
"Robert doesn't chase cheaters," Evelyn huffed. "He's a security consultant and a respected private detective."
"Private dick, you mean?"
Shane tugged on his mother's sleeve.
"You mean Uncle Rob is a real detective?"
"Well, yes, a great one."
Shane bounced on his toes, his head brimming with questions. What sort of cases did Uncle Rob take? Did he carry a gun? Why did he have video cameras everywhere?
Speaking of videos, maybe his uncle had a big, nice color TV for Saturday morning cartoons. Scooby-Doo would be on soon.
Kevin double-tapped the car horn. "Let's get a move on, babe."
Evelyn put her hands on her hips and stood her ground, her gaze frostier than the wind.
"Not until you apologize to me."
"And to me," Shane threw in.
"And to Shane," his mother said. "To him?" Kevin asked. "For what?"
Shane wanted to say for ruining his life, but instead he chose Kevin's most recent transgressions, minor though they were.
"At breakfast you called me a sissy for writing a letter to bring Star Trek back."
"That show was canceled because it's communistic. Kumbaya crap. Russians and Americas in space? No way."
Kevin glanced up as if he could see through the car's roof.
"The moon is American now."
"The moon belongs to everyone," Shane said, "and you use the last of the butter and maple syrup at breakfast, leaving me with none."
Kevin looked at his fiancée's stern face, then threw up his hands and took a deep breath. He launched into a rambling apology that covered the morning's transgressions, including leaving Shane with dry pancakes. Shane watched incredulously as Kevin finished with his fake smile, the one that didn't touch his eyes. The man could be charming when he wanted to be, and his poor mother always fell for it. Just like now. Seemingly satisfied, Evelyn turned to her son.
"I love you."
"Yeah, I love you too, Mom."
"Good. Let's reintroduce you to your uncle."
Shane picked up his bag, shot the bird at Kevin behind his back, and walked with his mother to the front door. He rang the doorbell of Uncle Robert Q. Blake's fortress-like home and wondered what was in store for him. The answer was more pancakes, made from scratch, and all the Saturday morning cartoons Shane could watch. Not only was Uncle Rob's Zenith television in color, it had a glorious 25-inch screen and a Space Command remote control. It was a strange but wonderful experience to sit on Uncle's couch and change the channels without getting up. Click, H.R. Puffin Stuff. Click, The Perils of Penelope Pit Stop.
Hey, Shane, do you like maple syrup on your pancakes? Called a voice from the kitchen.
Lots, and butter.
Uncle Rob emerged moments later with a plate of steaming pancakes and a newspaper tucked under his arm. He set the plate on a TV tray in front of Shane, sat down on a recliner, and unfolded the morning news to the front page. The top headline read, "Thefts continue at Centauri Circuits. Police baffled."
"Well, here comes the hatchet job," Uncle Rob muttered.
Shane didn't know what his uncle meant, and he didn't ask. What he did know was that he liked Uncle Rob a lot. The man was older than Shane's mother, probably mid-40s, with the same yellow hair and easy smile. While getting Shane settled, he'd patiently answered his nephew's questions about being a private investigator, including details of his current case of industrial espionage at Centauri Circuits. To Shane's relief, Uncle Rob took the strained circumstances of their visit in stride with few questions about his sister's trip or her fiancé. When asked what Kevin Cook did for a living, Shane replied that the man owned a trucking company.
"Well, that's some car he drives," Uncle Rob said.
He seemed to be fishing for something good or comforting to say about Shane's future stepfather.
"Paid cash for it. He's been flashing cash everywhere lately."
"Lately? Isn't he rich?" Shane knitted his brows.
"Well, I didn't think so, but he is now."
That last comment elicited a raised eyebrow from Uncle Rob and a contemplative hmm as he continued reading the paper. On the zenith, a cloud of bats flew in front of a creepy old mansion. A familiar theme song began to play.
"So, what are you watching this fine Saturday?" Uncle Rob asked.
"Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? It's my favorite show."
Uncle Rob chuckled. "Scooby-Doo, huh? Sounds like a bad Sinatra lyric. What's it about?" Shane explained the show's premise between mouthfuls of pancakes of how the group of teenage sleuths and their talking dog drove around in the mystery machine and unmasked criminals disguised as monsters. Uncle Rob paused from reading the newspaper and watched the show. After a time, he asked,
"Why is the skinny guy in the green shirt always hungry?"
Shane shrugged.
"Well, I don't know. He and Scooby-Doo are always hungry."
"Scooby-Dooby-Doo? Mystery solved."
"Huh?"
Shane said. "Never mind." Uncle Rob returned to the newspaper, frowning over the article about his client's troubles. While Shane watched, Scooby and the gang investigated a supposed pirate ghost ship.
"Where'd that spooky fog come from?" Shane said.
Uncle Rob glanced out a window.
What fog?"
No, on the show. The ghost of Pirate Redbeard is looting the cargoes of shipping company. His ghost ship is surrounded by fog."
"Why does a ghost need a steel cargo?" Uncle Rob asked absently.
"Revenge. Redbeard was captured 300 years ago by the ship owner's ancestors."
"Uh-huh."
Uncle Rob crumpled the newspaper in his lap.
"No suspects? Like that's somehow my fault?" "There's a suspect, all right," Shane said. "The ship owner's butler looked like a real creep."
"What?
No, I'm talking about my case. Here, read this." Uncle Rob handed the newspaper to his nephew.
During a commercial break, Shane read the article about the confounding thefts at Centauri Circuits.
The reporters think every case is solvable. If only you had a superior mind to examine the facts, Uncle Rob fumed. The mysteries of the world aren't all Sherlock Holmes, you know. Some cases just aren't solvable, no matter who the detective is.
Well, the Hardy Boys always solve their cases, Shane said as he finished reading. So does Scooby.
Uncle Rob smiled indulgently. That's the difference between mystery fiction and real life. In a book or TV show, the writers put in the necessary clues that allow the detective and the audience to solve the case. We meet all the suspects, hear all the stories, we sift the data. In many real-life cases, there are no suspects at all. Criminals get away, scot-free, all the time. Shane put down the newspaper, his expression thoughtful. For months, circuit boards manufactured at Centauri Circuits for NASA had gone missing. The components were loaded and accounted for when placed on a federal contractor's trucks to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. But some were always missing once unloaded. The contractor's trucks were electronically locked, and the drivers didn't have the combinations to unlock them. In spite of this, somewhere between Fort Worth and Florida, someone was pilfering the trucks for space-aged secrets. The reporter ended the article by lambasting the company's private security consultant, Robert Q. Blake, pictured in jeans and cowboy boots, with Centauri's CEO, Marvin Sungum.
"So you are the incompetent bumpkin they're writing about?" Shane asked.
Unfortunately, yes. Uncle Rob's phone rang. Hello? Yes, Mr. Sungun, I read the article.
What? There's been a burglary?
Shane could hear an angry voice coming through the receiver, in addition to profanity that would have earned him a month's grounding. Shane caught the words FBI, locked office, and shipping manifest. On the Zenith, Scooby-Doo and the gang had captured the pirate Redbeard in an elaborate trap. When the ghost's mask was removed, Shane gasped. It wasn't the shipping owner's butler after all, as Shane had suspected, but the owner himself. The episode ended with Scooby cutting a donut-shaped hole in the thick fog, licking his chops, and taking a big bite. What a crazy dog.
Tell your employees not to touch anything, Sungum, Uncle Rob said into the phone.
No, they should leave everything as it is, even the broken glass in your office. I'm going up there now. Uncle Rob hung up the phone, then turned to Shane and smiled. Well, nephew, how'd you like to take a little trip with me?
Where?
The world headquarters of Centauri Circuits. We're going to investigate last night's break-in.
Oh, boy!
Shane grinned from ear to ear. He couldn't believe he was going to investigate a real case. Later that morning, Shane found himself in the posh offices of Mr. Marvin Sungum, CEO of Centauri Circuits. His uncle was in earnest conversation with a police officer named Jefferson and a stocky FBI agent about the security camera footage while Sungum talked on the phone with his company's insurance carrier. A wall safe stood open behind the executive, and papers were scattered everywhere. On the opposite wall, most of a large window running from floor to ceiling lay in shards on the floor. The window had formed part of the wall with a hallway outside. Apparently, this was how the thief had entered the office.
You'd better pay those policies, Sungum was saying.
He was a fat man, with thinning brown hair, and his jowls quivered when he talked.
What did I buy the blasted insurance for anyway?
The company is on the verge of ruin as it is. Yes, Detective Blake is here, for all the good he does. He's as useless as the police and the FBI, if you ask me. Shane saw his uncle, Officer Jefferson, and the FBI agent pause their conversation to stare daggers at the businessman.
Uncle Rob was not a large man, but Shane saw a fierceness below that surface that should give anyone pause to offend him. The police officer finished his briefing about the break-in, said goodbye to Shane, and left. The FBI agent handed Uncle Rob a card and said, "We need to find those components before they hit the black market, Mr. Blake. Call that number day or night if you come up with anything. Ask for Agent Ortiz." "Of course." After Agent Ortiz departed, Sungun slammed down his phone receiver. He looked at Shane and said, "Who's the kid?" "Marvin, this is Shane, my nephew. He's staying with me for the holidays. Say hello, Shane."
"Hello, pleased to meet you."
Sungun lit a cigarette. "Well, good manners, I like that. Pleased to meet you, young man."
"Don't worry, sir. My uncle will solve this case."
"Well, I hope you're right," Sungum said, "because it's my butt if he doesn't, pardon my French."
"I reviewed last night's security footage with the police and the FBI," Uncle Rob said.
"At least what there was of it. The new camera lost power last night at 11:36 when someone cut the wires outside."
"Did the camera catch his face?" Sungum asked.
Uncle Rob shook his head. "No, unfortunately, no. Funny thing is, my alarm system had its own DC power supply as a failsafe. It shouldn't have mattered if the outside wires were cut. Someone disconnected the failsafe and no alarm sounded."
Sungum ground his cigarette in an ashtray next to perhaps a dozen others, then flipped the butts into an empty wastebasket.
"Whoever this was, detective, they were one step ahead of you."
"Marvin, who was in your office yesterday?" Uncle Rob asked.
Sungum tapped the double chin thoughtfully.
"Well, I left about 5:30 p.m., sharp, as always. Then the nightly cleaning crew at 8:15 p.m. They already told the police and FBI they didn't notice anything unusual."
Uncle Rob frowned. "Who called the authorities?"
"Well, I did," Sungun answered, "right after one of my employees called me. She came to work this morning to find the power off. She stumbled around in the dark for a few minutes, then went to the basement and switched on the emergency generators. When she saw the broken glass, she called me at home. I called the police, the FBI, and you."
Shane spoke up.
"What time did you arrive on the scene, sir?"
The two men looked at each other, both surprised that the boy had interjected himself into an adult conversation.
Sungum laughed and said, "Which of the Hardy boys are you?"
"Frank," Shane said. "He's the level-headed one."
"He's my favorite, too." Sungum stood up from behind the desk and began gathering up the papers on the floor.
"Well, to answer your question, I only arrived about 15 minutes ago because of traffic jam on Loop 820. I came to my office to find police and FBI agents combing over everything. Shane, can you reach the paper under the desk? My knees aren't what they used to be."
"Well, sure thing."
"Be careful of the broken glass," Uncle Rob said.
Shane got down on his knees.
"Well, there's not much glass in here," he said as he retrieved papers from under the desk.
Uncle Rob rubbed his chin at that, while Shane glanced over the papers before handing them to Mr. Sungum. Shane saw what looked like circuitry diagrams, along with shipping schedules and combination codes for locks. On one schedule, a familiar company name caught his eye. His heart skipped a beat, but he said nothing as he handed the last paper to Sungum.
Is something wrong, Shane? Uncle Rob whispered.
Shane put a cautionary finger over his lips while Sungum's attention was on sorting the papers into stacks.
"Well, all here, it seems," Sungum said. "I suppose the thief could have taken photographs, eh?"
"Yeah, most likely," Uncle Rob said.
"What was in the safe, sir?" Shane asked.
Sungun took out a handkerchief and wiped the sweat from his brow.
"Well, on your uncle's advice, I kept the most current shipping schedules in the safe, as well as the combination codes to the electronic locks used on the contractor's trucks. But that's the least of my worries."
I don't understand, Shane said.
I kept circuit diagrams for NASA's latest and greatest rocket in this safe. Someone could make a fortune on the black market selling technical secrets to the highest bidder. America could find herself ultimately losing the space race, despite putting a man on the moon.
Wow, Shane said.
Wow is right. If this news gets out, my company stock will become worthless overnight.
What the devil is going on out there?
Sundgren looked out a window to the parking lot below, then cursed. Outside, local news vans were setting up shops for their evening news.
Well, it looks like the buzzards are circling, Uncle Rob said.
I better get down there and do some damage control.
Sundgren opened a large wooden wardrobe, took out a trench coat and hat. As the fat man stalked out of the room, his shoes crunched loudly over the broken glass in the hallway. When the businessman was gone, Shane opened the wardrobe and looked inside. Aside from some ghastly paisley ties and plaid business suits, he saw nothing unusual.
What are you doing? Uncle Rob asked.
Just looking around.
What did you see on those papers you handed Sundgren?
Shane's dimples flashed in a smile.
Cook Carriers is one of the shipping companies running equipment to Florida. That's the company that belongs to Mom's fiancé.
Uncle Rob clapped Shane on the shoulder.
The man flaunting all that cash.
Good show, Shane.
That might be entirely a coincidence, but it's worth checking out.
We'll get right on it when we're done here.
Maybe we can stop the wedding, Shane said wistfully.
Nah, don't get your hopes up.
But Cook, or whoever is actually stealing the equipment, has an accomplice. A man or a woman on the inside at Centauri Circuits, the mastermind behind it all, and we have no suspects.
Oh, yes, we do.
Shane picked up the ashtray on Sungum's desk. There were a dozen butts already in this ashtray before Mr. Sundgren added the last one. The cleaning crew would have emptied the ashtray last night, so those were smoked after they left.
Go on.
When I asked Mr. Sundgren, said he'd been in the office for 15 minutes this morning, Shane continued excitedly. He couldn't have smoked all those cigarettes in that time. And he would have said something if someone else had filled his ashtray since his supposed departure yesterday.
Excellent deductions, Uncle Rob said.
Shane grinned. This wasn't the false praise adults sometimes heaped on kids. His uncle was in earnest, and it pleased Shane no end.
So, continued Uncle Rob, Marvin Sundgren lied to us and the authorities about the times he'd been here. Let's suppose Sundgren was here last night. If the office was locked from the inside and the cleaning crew didn't see him, where was he?
Shane opened the wardrobe wider.
Well, this is big enough for Mr. Sundgren to hide in while the cleaning crew was in here. Hey, there's a folded metal chair between those suits.
A chair in a wardrobe? Uncle Rob came over and inspected the wardrobe and its contents, careful not to touch anything with his bare hands. Next to a chair leg, he found a flashlight.
Well, that's not suspicious in the least, eh?
So the cleaners finished, left, and locked the door. All while Sundgren was in the wardrobe, sitting in his chair with his flashlight.
Then he smoked his cigarettes at his desk while he waited for his accomplice to arrive and cut the power,
Shane said.
Then he ransacked his own office.
Well, that sounds possible, Uncle Rob said.
Even probable. We have a method. Now let's explore his motives. Why do you suppose he would steal his own components? Why ruin his company's stock by implying the circuit diagrams were duplicated or somehow compromised?
Insurance fraud, Shane said. Just like the bad guy on this morning's Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? The ship owner dressed up as a pirate to loot his own ships.
Very good, Shane. What about those ruined stocks?
Well, maybe the plans are worth more than the stocks.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. Uncle Rob agreed. That said, too many cigarette butts in the ashtray plus a chair and a flashlight in the wardrobe are pretty thin evidence.
Shane let out a long sigh.
Well, I guess extra cash in Kevin's pockets isn't much to go on either.
Don't give up yet, Shane.
Do you see anything else here that can knock a hole in Sungrim's story? Shane turned to Uncle Rob to see a devilish smile on the man's face. Had some new clue revealed itself?
A hole?
His uncle nodded. A big hole, as a matter of fact. Shane looked around the office at the wall safe, the desk, and the wardrobe. There was evidently another clue here, but he couldn't see what it was for the life of him. Then his eyes fell on the wall window shattered glass, and something clicked in his mind. A very big hole, Uncle Rob. There's more glass in the hallway than there is in the office.
Right. And what does that mean?
Shane stood in front of the broken window. He imagined someone in the hallway breaking the glass and coming inside. Then he imagined Sungum picked up something heavy, like a chair, and smashed the window from inside. Where would the glass go?
The glass was broken inside, knocking more glass into the hallway than into the office.
When Mr. Sungum was finished, he left through the window, leaving only the fingerprints from the cleaning crew on the already locked door.
This case is wrapping up with some help from Scooby-Doo, Uncle Rob laughed.
He picked up the phone on the desk, took out the FBI agent's card, and dialed.
Hello, FBI. This is Detective Rob Blake over at Centauri Circuits in Fort Worth. I need to speak to Agent Joe Ortiz about a new suspect.
New suspects, Shane corrected.
He had a vision of Kevin Cook throwing dice in the casino, oblivious to the dark-suited FBI agents approaching from behind to take him in for questioning on charges of espionage and conspiracy to sell national secrets.
Shane's wish came true on Christmas Eve, a day before the planned wedding, as he and his uncle watched the evening news on the resplendent zenith.
There was Kevin Cook, handcuffed, being escorted out of a Vegas hotel by a horde of grim-faced government agents. The newscaster described Cook as the alleged accomplice of criminal mastermind Marvin Sungum in the recent thefts of space-age technology from Sungum's own company, Centauri Circuits.
The image on the television switched to a recording of Sungum, red-faced and handcuffed, being led away from his office building.
The fat man answered the shouts of reporters with a querulous voice, "And I would have gotten away with it, too, if it hadn't been for that meddlesome kid."
Uncle Rob lifted an eggnog into the air as a toast.
"Nephew, we did pretty well for an incompetent bumpkin and a meddlesome kid."
"Yes, sir, we did."
Shane clinked glasses with his uncle and drained his eggnog. He thought fondly of his mother flying home in time for Christmas dinner at Uncle Rob's, saved from a horrible mistake. Following Kevin's arrest, Evelyn Mitchell had been so distraught she'd initially refused to answer phone calls to her hotel room. But her tears soon dried up when she finally picked up and listened to Uncle Rob's explanation of Kevin's nefarious role in the Centauri scheme.
"Shane cracked the case," Uncle Rob told her.
"My Shane caught the crooks and saved those space secrets? All by himself?
Well, he had a little help from me," Uncle Rob winked at Shane.
"And a talking dog."
All right, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Twist Phelan brings us our next story. It's called Pay Dirt.
The man pushed the wheelbarrow along the verge past the trucks waiting their turn at inspection before crossing the Irish border. The British-Irish border, if you're a unionist. Same as he did yesterday morning, and the morning before that, and the morning before that. Dennis Barr watched the man through binoculars he'd brought from home. An avid bird watcher, he owned several pairs. The wheelbarrow was piled high with blocks of turf, peat, if you're a unionist, a rake and a shovel sticking out of the load like chopsticks in a takeout carton. 6 months ago, Dennis had joined Irish Revenue as an officer. Gouger, if you're a unionist. The Irish government agency responsible for, among other things, collecting customs duties and detecting seizing smuggled goods. He'd spent the past week conducting random roadside checks at the border. Every day since he set up his checkpoint, the man had appeared pushing the wheelbarrow. Dennis signaled for the man to stop. "Morning, Ray." The man set down his wheelbarrow, hitched up his tracksuit bottoms, trackies if you're a unionist, and leaned against the 60 kph, Republic of Ireland, 60 mph, Northern Ireland, speed limit sign. "Bout you, Dennis." Dennis walked around the wheelbarrow painted green and missing one of its orange handles. It was stacked with rectangular blocks of dried turf. Recent environmental laws restricted the use of the soil-rich in decayed plants, a fuel source for heating and cooking in Ireland for centuries, to gardening purposes. The rake and shovel poking up from the stack of turf were dirty. Wrapped around their handles was orange tape inked with the initials R.C. R.C. stood for Ray Comerford, scion of a well-known crime family from the north of Ireland. Ulster, if you're a unionist. Drug and human trafficking, along with cigarette and tobacco smuggling, were the family's specialities. After recognizing Ray the first time he'd stopped him, the man's face and name had been all over the news after his release from prison a few months back. Dennis had called his gaffer for direction. "Take him apart, Ray," his gaffer instructed. "If he's a comfort, you can be sure he's up to something, Bent." Despite thumbing through the reg book and checking Revenue's online database, Dennis couldn't find any assessment to levy. Turf apparently moved across the border duty-free, even after Brexit. Next, he examined the wheelbarrow and tools, ordinary types found in any builder's supply, but no contraband was hidden in the wheelbarrow's tire or the shovel's handles. Finally, he had Ray unload the bricks of dirt. Dennis checked each one, finding only a few beetles and slugs. When the wheelbarrow was reloaded, Dennis said, "The Republic's got plenty of its own turf. Why are you bringing it in this lot?" Ray slid a Raleigh, fag if you're a unionist, from his pocket. "My wife's from Dundalk." Dennis was familiar with the town just south of the border. It was minutes from Black Rock Beach, one of his favorite bird-watching spots. Ray lit the cigarette, took a drag, then said, "Our parents are still there and they're getting on. Now that I've learned my lesson and retired from the family business, she wants to live closer to them. I told her I'm fine with that, so long as I can bring a bit of me home dirt with me. So that's what I'm doing." Dennis didn't buy for a minute Ray's claim he'd changed his ways, but without evidence of wrongdoing, he had no choice but to let the man pass. The next day, Ray was back, along with the wheelbarrow, missing the orange handle, the tape-labeled tools, and a fresh load of turf. Dennis again checked the wheelbarrow, the tools, the turf, and again he came up empty. "Why don't you truck it in?" he asked, brushing bits of turf from his trousers. Ray grinned, stretched. "Eh, there's nothing nicer than a spring in Ireland. After all those years inside, I'm in the mood for a dander. A walk, if you're a unionist." Reluctantly, Dennis waved Ray across the border. The next day, when Ray again appeared pushing the wheelbarrow, Dennis redoubled his inspection efforts. He pulled off the wheelbarrow's remaining orange grip and looked down the handle. Empty. He checked the inside of the tire's inner tubes. Nothing. He scraped paint off the wheelbarrow to see if they were made of precious metal. Nope. He unwound the orange tape from the tool handles. Nothing hidden underneath. Dennis even had a sample of the turf overnighted to a crime lab for analysis. Check for everything, he said. Drugs, gold, rare earth minerals, anything else you can think of. It's just turf, the lab had reported. Today marked Ray's 8th appearance at Dennis's checkpoint. He leaned against the speed limit sign and smoked while he watched the revenue officer inspect the wheelbarrow of turf yet again.
You're wasting your time, he said. I told you, I'm playing it straight. Me and my wife's cousin, we're starting a legit business.
Sure you are, Dennis thought. You're cleared to cross, he said. Another 2 days passed, with Dennis and Ray repeating the now familiar routine. But on the third day, Ray didn't appear. He no-showed the next, Dennis's last on checkpoint duty as well. Dennis decided to take a few days of annual leave before starting his next assignment. He spent them bird-watching along the lower coast of County Down and the upper part of County Louth, too. The afternoon of the last day of his holiday found him in Dundalk, on his way back from Blackrock Beach, where he'd been pleased to spot both a western cattle egret and a pectoral sandpiper. Wanting a bite before the drive home, he found a chipper, Chippy if you're a unionist, and was enjoying his fried battered whitefish and thick-cut chips drizzled with vinegar when he noticed a small truck parked across the street. R. Comerford, Garden Maintenance, was stenciled on the door. Among the jumble of equipment in the bed was a wheelbarrow with one orange handle.
Maybe Ray was telling the truth about going straight, Dennis thought.
He was disposing of the wrappers from his meal into the bin when another small truck pulled up beside the first. R. Comerford Garden Maintenance was printed on its door, too. In the back he saw a mower and other gardening equipment, including another wheelbarrow with one orange handle, along with a rake and shovel with orange tape around their handles. An idea niggled at Dennis. He jogged across the street to the second truck.
Hey, I'm a property manager, he said to the driver. We're always on the lookout for new landscapers. How many trucks do you guys have?
10, the driver said. Dennis pointed at the truck's door. And R. Comerford is?
That'd be the owner, Ray Comerford, the driver said.
Dennis gestured at the wheelbarrow in the bed.
Looks like this one's missing a handle.
He nodded at the other truck.
That one, too. They all like that.
The driver thought for a moment.
Well, yeah, now that you mention it.
Hey, thanks for your time, Dennis said. He headed back to his car, already inputting the address on the side of the truck into the Maps app on his phone. When he was back in his car, he made a call, although he was fairly sure what the answer would be.
Put me through to whoever pulled second shift on the customer's checkpoint the last 2 weeks, he said, after identifying himself.
The wait wasn't long.
This is Leah McCaffrey. I'm calling about your customs checkpoint. Do you know who Ray Comerford is?
Who doesn't? He came through nearly every night last week, plus one before.
South to north?
Yeah.
Did he have a wheelbarrow?
A wheelbarrow? No.
Gardening tools.
He didn't have anything at all, just himself, walking.
Thanks, Dennis said.
He started his car and began following the driving directions. Ray Comerford could well be starting a lawful business. Still, the man just couldn't help himself. That's why he'd pushed a load of turf over the border 10 days in a row. The savings were probably 1,500, max 2,000 quid. But that was beside the point. Once a smuggler, even when it came to avoiding the fees and duties that would be owed on 10 imported wheelbarrows and the same number of rakes and shovels. Well, this'll warrant a celebratory pint of the black stuff. Guinness, if you're a unionist. When he got home, Dennis thought as he parked in front of the green metal building with "Our Cummerford Garden Maintenance" painted on its side. As he got out of his car, it occurred to Dennis he was as much a creature of habit as Ray was. After all, how many other revenue officers brought their citation book on holiday? Hulls, if you're a unionist. Alright, I'm going to switch to a different Ellery Queen mystery magazine for this story. It's from their Department of the First story, and it's called Nighthawks by James Hazelton. Now, Nighthawks, as you may know, is a famous painting by Edward Hopper. And this is the one where our vantage point is from about a half a block away, and we're looking into a diner at night. There's a man behind the counter with a paper cap on, couple of coffee urns, one man with his back to us, and around the corner of this coffee bar are a man and a woman seated there. Pretty famous painting. This story regards that painting. There's a lot that goes into being considered a piece of history. While I'm in my day-to-day, I go to extreme measures to keep myself undetected and absent from the minds of the people who see me in order to prevent any future retellings of my actions. This all being said, it was hard to tell he was even there. Mr. Hopper would have made an excellent spy in another life, but in this one he decided to be a painter. At the time, even if I had seen him, I probably wouldn't have given it much thought. There were plenty of tortured artists trying to make a name for themselves, and at the time, he didn't seem like he would amount to much of anything. I guess that goes to show you how good of an eye I had for art. It really is quite unlikely that not only this nobody would amount to anything, but that the painting in which he captured me would be known by so much of the world. You see, it was supposed to be a quick and easy job. Nothing like it turned out. The goal of a hitman is to go undetected, and while I was usually pretty good at my job, this assignment had more things go wrong than I could count. It started with Jimmy not showing up to his shift at the plant. I mean, I suppose it makes sense that you rob the head of the Italian mob. You don't have a reason to show up to your lousy plant job. It would have been so much easier if I could have tripped him into one of the machines. But that's how it goes. Then I find out he's been taking this lady he meant out, flaunting the money he'd stolen. He hardly ever went anywhere without her. More witnesses than I would need to deal with. It took me nearly a whole month to find my opening. At the time, lots of places started being open the whole night. It made it easier to appease the drunks getting off their night on the town to stay open for a few hours before the early breakfast crew of the plant workers. This recent change gave me the opportunity I needed. Maybe it was some sort of sick obsession I had developed, but I had to get close to them. I had to see the man who was so bold to piss off the most powerful man in the city. As I sat there, looking at them, I couldn't help but feel sorry for them. Here they were, just moments from their death, and they didn't know it. After he had his fill of coffee, they got up and rounded the corner. The next part was easy enough. I just followed them. Within 2 hours, they were in the Hudson. What should have been routine ended up immortalized, and anyone who gets even close to knowing the true story needs to go. I'm sorry you're finding out this way. Well, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Really, truly, indeed grateful that you tuned in. Keith Tyler here asking you to join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.